Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran wants to see tangible results out of the upcoming talks aimed at the removal of sanctions imposed on the country. The UK reports more than 37,000 new coronavirus cases and another 214 deaths. It's third day in a row now that the country is reporting over 200 fatalities. The World Health Organization says inequality in the distribution of COVID vaccines around the world is threatening the lives of health workers and vulnerable groups in poor nations. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us here on World News. Our top story, President Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran wants to see tangible results out of the upcoming talks aimed at the removal of sanctions imposed on the country. Raisi says Iran will not abandon the negotiation table, but will refuse to bow down to excessive demands that violate its national interests. The president believes U.S. sanctions against Iran are unjust and that Washington needs to remove them. Iran has confirmed the talks with the P4 plus one. The remaining parties to the nuclear accord are set to begin on November 29th in Vienna. Negotiations are aimed at removing sanctions that the U.S. reimposed on Iran after former President Donald Trump abandoned the deal back in May of 2018. Political commentator David Yagubian joined us earlier with his take on the story.
The Biden administration refuses to commit to the JCPOA and what would be American commitments to drop all of its sanctions under the agreement, instead seeking to maintain the ability for the United States to maintain some of its commitments and then withdraw from some of its commitments at will. And specifically and most importantly, the Biden administration isn't even guaranteeing that it will stay within the agreement for the duration of President Biden's term, even if Iran meets all of its commitments. So I think this is the context for President Raisi's statements, as well as Mikhail Ulyanov, the Russian representative to international institutions in Vienna, that it's time to have a results-oriented discussion that is designed to bring all parties back into full compliance with their JCPOA commitments. And for the United States, this would require it to drop all of the sanctions from the term of President Trump, and as well the sanctions that were maintained after the accord was signed in 2015 by the Obama administration.
A top Iranian general says a recent incident in the Sea of Oman proves Iran is serious in safeguarding its national interests and that its armed forces are fully prepared to stand against any external threats. Have a listen.
What happened on the 25th of October, the news of which was released yesterday, provides solid proof that the Iranian nation's youth will stand against any power that seeks to threaten their interests strongly, bravely, and faithfully.
Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says about 10 days ago its naval forces foiled a U.S. attempt to steal Iranian oil in the country's southern waters. IRGC's chief commander now says Iran has never been seeking war but will definitely defend itself. Major General Hossein Salami says Iran is a powerful country that serves as an anchor of security in the region. He called the U.S. history of making wars globally and called on regional states not to expect foreign powers to bring peace to West Asia. According to Salami, the U.S. power is declining and its allies are losing their trust in Washington.
The naval forces of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have managed to thwart an attempt by the United States to take over a giant oil tanker in the strategic Sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, intended to unload the shipment to another tanker and then direct it to an unknown destination. But IRGC forces reacted promptly and carried out a heli-borne operation on the stolen ship's deck, gained control of the vessel, and directed it back toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then proceeded to chase the tanker, using several helicopters and warships, but their attempt at taking over the vessel for a second time was thwarted again by Iranian naval forces. The tanker is currently in Iranian territorial waters and under the protection of IRGC's Navy.
The United States continues to use oil and weaponize oil against Iran because it has not been able to overthrow the Iranian Islamic Revolution in any other way.
Iran has repeatedly warned the U.S. about its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. Tehran says it has increased its patrols to secure the passage of Iranian ships and to combat fuel smuggling in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The U.S. will try to provoke some sort of conflict in the Persian Gulf because of this, and we have to keep this in mind because the Persian Gulf belongs to Iran and the people of the Middle East, not the United States. The United States should not be there to begin with.
Iranian officials say U.S. military presence in the region is a source of instability and insecurity. Iran believes the countries of the region are fully capable of providing their own security.
Now, the incident which took place in the Sea of Oman could have easily escalated and turned into a military confrontation between Iran and the U.S., but as it turned out, the IRGC forces were able to maintain their defensive posture throughout the operation. After all, executing a hellebore operation and recapturing the stolen consignment from the U.S. was no easy task. Tehran believes security of this region is best left to Iran and its neighbors.
The latest confrontation between the U.S. and Iran comes amid rising bilateral and regional tensions.
The United States continues its presence in the Persian Gulf because it is a key geopolitical trade route. Most of the energy, commerce, petroleum, commodities that are exchanged on the global market are done so in the Persian Gulf, because if we look geographically at a map, the Persian Gulf connects trade in Europe, across Egypt through the Suez Canal, and leads into the Indian Ocean.
Washington has tried to disrupt the legitimate oil trade of Iran with other countries. The U.S. has threatened Iran over its fuel deliveries to Lebanon and Venezuela. It believes that the sanctions it has imposed on Iran should be adhered by Iran under its so-called maximum pressure campaign. But this is a campaign that has failed, even admitted by some U.S. officials. Tensions have risen between Iran and the U.S. after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal as part of its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The campaign included tough economic sanctions combined with credible military threat. Washington's European allies failed to live up to their commitments.
For many years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the United States, Washington, London, the Western imperialist powers have done everything they can to try to overthrow the popular revolution, the government.
The administration of U.S. President Biden says it wants to rejoin the deal, but at the same time, it is pressing ahead with failed maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also said in a tweet that the talks to remove sanctions on Iran would fail unless U.S. President Joe Biden could guarantee that Washington would not renege on the nuclear agreements in the future.
And the U.S. maintains its presence in the Persian Gulf because it sees that Iran has been able to withstand so many imperialist attacks, and also that Iran has many friends around the world. Let's recall just a few weeks ago in the lead up to this piracy by the U.S. that Iran was able to successfully bring petroleum refineries to the nation of Venezuela.
Now, talks have been set to resume on November 29th, but the talks are aimed at removing illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran. That is Iran's approach towards the talks. Only time will tell whether the U.S. will remove the sanctions or that the talks will fail.
The UK has logged over 214 coronavirus deaths in the past day, marking a third consecutive day now that authorities have reported over 200 daily fatalities. Official data shows also that Britain's tested positive over 37,000 infections over the past day as well. UK has the highest number of COVID infections in Europe with over 9.2 million cases. It's also Europe's second deadliest hotspot with over 100 and 41,000 fatalities. UK has seen a surge in cases over the past couple of months. Uptick is largely blamed on a premature lifting of lockdowns and the relaxation of social distancing measures. The World Health Organization once again criticized inequality in the distribution of COVID vaccines around the world.
No more vaccines should go to countries that have already vaccinated more than 40% of their population until COVAX has the vaccines it needs to help other countries get there too. No more boosters should be administered except to immunocompromised people.
WHO chief said that most countries with a high vaccine rollout are ignoring the agency's calls to halt giving out booster shots. Tedros noted the move is threatening the lives of health workers and vulnerable groups in poorer nations where many have yet to receive a single dose. He also criticized vaccine manufacturers for not cooperating with the UN-backed initiative for the distribution of vaccines to lower-income countries. Tedros said that the COVAX scheme has the money and the contracts needed, but manufacturers have not played their part. U.S. Congress approves legislation to hike diplomatic pressure on the Nicaraguan government in the run-up to the country's presidential election. Legislation provides a host of measures to address what Washington calls corruption and human rights abuses by the government of President Daniel Ortega. This includes a series of sanctions against people involved in the alleged human rights abuses. In recent months, police have arrested a number of opposition figures in the Latin American country for inciting foreign interference. Nicaragua is to hold a presidential election Sunday, in which Ortega is expected to win a fourth consecutive term. And joining us now out of Managua for the latest is Camila Escalante. Hello, Camila. Hope you're safe and doing well out there. What can you tell us?
Absolutely. So that passed yesterday. This is going to pave the way and send us in the direction of the sanctions, the unilateral coercive measures that have been waged on Venezuela, a situation of heightening the war on Nicaragua and just turning this into a whole new level of a hybrid war. They've been ramping up their media campaign and propaganda campaign against Nicaragua. Beginning early this year, we began seeing statements and declarations being dropped by the OAS, by the State Department, and by different congressmen and other U.S. officials. And they've already, just a couple of months ago, had already called or announced new sanctions. That was the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, against certain officials of the Sandinista government. And so they tried to pretend as if those are targeted sanctions that will only affect those individuals named that are supposed to be high-ranking officials of the government. But in fact, we know that they affect the Nicaraguan people in general. They say that this is about the government repressing people's freedom of speech, other fundamental freedoms. They say that as you said in the intro there, that the opposition members and so-called candidates have been jailed. The fact is that those people were, if anything, pre-candidates, that they didn't have a corresponding party, that they weren't registered, because at the time that this took place, the official inscription into this election hadn't even been open to candidates.
All right, thank you, Camila, and stay safe. I'm sure we'll follow this election very closely and check back with you routinely. Joining us now from Managua, that was Camila Escalante. Meanwhile, journalists in India have been grappling with a growing spate of violence over the last few years. Manowar Zaman has your story.
Soon after Prime Minister Modi won a landslide victory in the 2014 general elections, like other leaders, he wouldn't shy away from talking about the spirit of democracy. The Prime Minister said democracy will sustain only by freedom of speech and expression. But in Modi's new India, it looks like a different story altogether. Journalists in the world's largest democracy are caught in a limbo, not just about how to report, but also what to report. Many fear for personal safety, right to report the facts, while others are intimidated, harassed, and even charged under draconian and sedition laws. Some are threatened aggressively. A poignant case is that of Indian journalist Neha Dixit, who revealed a horrifying ordeal while receiving a prestigious International Press Freedom Award.
The last couple of years have been about endless follow-up on legal cases, death threats and rape threats, complete with descriptions of how it should be conducted on my body. They've also been about being held physically hostage by right-wing Hindu fundamentalists while reporting.
Nevertheless, the show goes on while tuning in to watch your favorite primetime, where abuses, yelling, personal attacks, and at times cracking laughter is a routine. According to New York-based hybrid research and journalism organization, The Police Project, 256 reports of violence against journalists in India were recorded from May 2019 till August 2021. Media experts say press freedom has further diminished after the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP. Recent years have seen a dramatic rise in violence against journalists while they were covering stories on different issues. Social media is also becoming a tool for trolling and threatening not just journalists, but anyone. Many renowned journalists and media personalities have now shifted their platforms in the pursuit of truth and perhaps the other way of the narrative. Rather than appearing on big platforms, they have resorted to social media as an easy tool to put forth their side of the stories.
There is a culture which is not limited to one political party or a particular government, but there is a culture now that has been developed where people who kind of bring out inconvenient truths are questioned.
Experts say after the emergence of BJP in India, there is a sense of polarized environment where journalists find themselves more divided, while many are still confused if it's all about patronizing the popular rather than speaking about the unpopular. But the never-ending or perhaps unwanted debates find more space in Indian media platforms rather than the ones that makes difference. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tourism.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the 15th episode of our series, Health Tourism. In this program, we are going to focus on cosmetic or aesthetic surgery in Iran and those medical tourists who want to improve their appearance using plastic or cosmetic surgery. Please stay with us. Beauty is one of the characteristics and innate desires of human beings. Just about everyone wants to look beautiful, and this is one of the important reasons why many people spend a lot of time and money to improve their looks and become more beautiful, and this can lead to cosmetic surgery. Plastic surgery is performed in the world for the purpose of repair or beauty and consists of two types: invasive and minimally invasive. The aggressive type includes liposuction, rhinoplasty, blepharoplasty, abdominoplasty, etc. Among the types of minimally invasive surgeries that are very popular in the world, we can mention Botox injection, filler injection, fat injection, laser hair removal, and microdermabrasion. Global statistics show that over the past 20 years, consumers of cosmetics and applicants for cosmetic surgery have increased by 80%. According to International Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgery, that is ISAPS, the United States has the highest rate of cosmetic surgery, followed by Brazil and Japan. Based on the number of surgeries performed in the world, it should be said that 12% of surgeries in the world are performed in these three countries. According to available statistics, the demand for cosmetic surgery is higher among women in a way that more than 85% of cosmetic surgeries are demanded by women. But men are not far behind in cosmetic surgery. The most popular surgeries among men are eyelid surgery, rhinoplasty, liposuction, and hair transplantation. In every country, the type of surgery varies according to the culture of that country. For example, in South Korea and Japan, eyelid surgery or blepharoplasty is the highest demanded surgery, since the people of these countries prefer to have eyes similar to Westerners. Among Iranians, rhinoplasty is the most popular cosmetic surgery, followed by oral and maxillofacial surgeries. Injections, lift and liposuction surgeries, which are considered the main cosmetic surgeries in Iran. However, in terms of the number of different types of surgeries, Iran stands at the 20th place in the world. The interest for rhinoplasty among Iranians has caused local physicians to become the best and most experienced doctors in rhinoplasty in the world. And thus, Iran is known as the capital of rhinoplasty in the world. In the following, we will talk more about rhinoplasty surgery in Iran. Iran is known as one of the leading countries in the West Asia region in the field of cosmetic surgery. The high quality of cosmetic surgery services in Iran and the low cost of providing these services compared to developed countries have paved the way for the development of medical and health tourism in Iran. In recent years, Iran has been able to rank 17th in the world in the field of medical sciences and first in West Asia, which has caused health tourists from different countries to come to Iran for various surgeries, especially cosmetic surgeries. It should be noted that cosmetic surgeries or plastic surgeries are not always performed to make a person more beautiful. Rather, in many cases, these surgeries help those people who have defects in their face and limbs to recover and return to their normal life. And this is one of the great achievements of medical science. The history of plastic surgery in Iran dates back to about 9 years ago, when Dr. Ali Ehsanlu went to the United States to undergo plastic and reconstructive surgery courses. And after returning to Iran, he began teaching and working in this field. he established a department called Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at the University of Tehran and performed the first cosmetic surgery in 1307 AD. Dr. Ali Ehsanlu is called the father of Iranian plastic surgery. Over the years, due to the increasing number of cosmetic surgeries in Iran, especially rhinoplasty, Iranian surgeons have become very skilled in various types of surgery. For example, a plastic surgeon in Europe and the United States performs only few cosmetic surgeries per week, while in Iran, a plastic surgeon can perform up to 4 cosmetic procedures per day. This has caused foreign tourists to come to Iran and have their nose surgery performed by experienced Iranian doctors. According to the statistics, most health tourists are from the West Asia region, Central Asia, Europe, Australia, the United States, as well as Iranians living outside Iran. Other cosmetic surgeries that are very popular in Iran with experienced surgeons working in that field, we can mention cosmetic surgeries of the jaw, face, and teeth. This type of surgery is one of the most sensitive fields in beauty. In fact, maxillofacial surgery is a field in which specialists in general dentistry and specialized courses pass and then perform oral maxillofacial surgery in specialty and subspecialty hospitals. The scope of activities in this field is very wide and includes treatment of head and face fractures, treatment of congenital anomalies of the head and face, treatment of benign and malignant lesions, treatment of infections, cosmetic facial surgery, and oral and implant surgeries. For example, a person who suffers from major injuries to the appearance of the face, jaw, cheeks, etc., as a result of a car accident or fall from a height, can be treated by experts of this field. The biggest goals of these doctors are treatment and reconstruction of body parts in the face and skull, in terms of efficiency and beauty. Due to the expertise of Iranian physicians in the field of oral medicine and also the high cost of treatment in other countries, many European, Australian, and American citizens, as well as Iranian citizens living abroad, tend to use the medical services of the Iranian physicians and, in addition to treatment, also visit the beauties of Iran. Dear listeners, we have reached the end of this program. Till next time, goodbye.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have dear sister, Sister Razia Shamani. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
We talked about the exemplary treatment Rasulullah had, not only toward his own daughters or the daughters of Sayyidah Khadija, but the daughters of all his wives, his stepdaughters. But he respected them, he cared for them, I think he even taught them in certain points. Well, such a blessing for those women to be in the proximity of Habibullah, you know, the beloved of Allah.
The noble prophet paid, like, he invested so much emotional
energy
into his daughters. and into the girls in his family. And beautifully, all this warmth, love and attention and extra care to these girls, which you might think that he's spoiling them, turned these women to be brave, strong, influential women in their history. Over decades, there have been so much emphasis on the role on empowering women that men have been driven to the periphery. Our mentality, our thoughts are shaped by our surroundings. Whatever we're saying now, we might be saying something else in a year. Our thoughts might be completely different.
Yes, yes. Naturally so.
We stay to the core and the principles of Islam, but then so many other things, which are outer layers of our thoughts and reflections, they change. One of our professors in university was saying that even the term mothering is a new phenomenon.
How so?
Because in the past century or so, the understanding of one regarding the concept of mothering has changed so much. Because prior to factories being present and, you know, when people back in the time when agriculturalism and farming was there, the parents working side by side one another. And raising the kids wasn't a duty of the woman. Because they had, like, so many children around the house, like 6, 7, 8 children. And then the eldest daughter or the eldest son took care of the smaller ones, right? So it wasn't the mother, it wasn't the woman who took care of all these children.
It was like a systematic share
exactly,
of responsibilities.
Exactly.
Okay.
And fathering and mothering had the same weight.
Right.
Had the same, like, stance and position. And it was, like, the mother. But then, when things changed in the society...
I blame it all on the world wars. You know, men went and died.
To the world wars and to so many other facts, to modernity. They usually blame it on modernity. So after, like, men had to move away from the home...
Yeah, it's fine.
They had to move away from the home, and they were the ones bringing money, and then it was the woman, like, fewer children, and then, like... The whole style of family life changed from an extended family to a nuclear family with less children.
Yes.
And, you know, then mothering took a totally new term and
definition.
So even this mothering that me and you have in mind, God knows. Because when you look at the teachings of Islam, I'm going to try to explain in a way that I wouldn't cause any misunderstandings, but you don't see that many duties defined for a woman and mother in the Islamic teachings, where you see a heavy weight of responsibilities laid on the man as the husband and as the father. Right? And this mothering thing, which has been going on for the past couple of decades, it's something that we somehow coined it.
We're going to go on a short break, and we're going to be right back, so don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady here in the studio. I'm with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're talking about the historical details behind the life of the numerous daughters of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We see so much emphasis in Islam that Islam lays upon choosing a good mother for your kids. I mean,
also a good father.
Yeah, but if her sole responsibility was just, you know, birth the child. And more of the weight being on the man. So it doesn't matter if you just marry a mediocre, average woman, not necessarily that.
First of all, biologically speaking, and also the environment, the womb in which the child is growing, it leaves a lot of biological and psychological and spiritual impact on the child. This is proven. I'm not saying that... this woman who gives birth to this child will have to just, you know, just remain careless. After all, in the Noble Quran, it says, وَالْمُؤْمِنُونَ وَالْمُؤْمِنَاتُ بَعْضُهُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ بَعْضٍ يَأْمُرُونَ بِالْمَعْرُوفَ يَنْهَوْنَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. The faithful men and women are comrades of one another.
Mm.
They bid what is right and forbid what is wrong. Generally speaking, as a general principle in Islam, كُلُّكُمْ رَعْ وَكُلُّكُمْ مَسْئُولًا رَيَّتْ. All of you are responsible with regards to your subjects.
Yep.
Like the Amir is responsible with regards to his subjects. The man is responsible with regards to his family. The woman is responsible with regards to her husband's house and children.
Mm.
Right? But I'm the point I want to say is that this heavy burden that we're trying to put on women and try to highlight mothering so much, this is something that has later on been added to the Islamic, or it's not even an Islamic culture, to the culture of the world.
If it's so, then why can't you just go work outside? If it's really not that important, because I'm really conflicted by this matter.
Mm.
If her presence and her contribution isn't as important as the man's, why in God's name? I mean, the man has more the responsibility, obviously, that will equal in his greater contribution.
You can't really say that he has... the quality of the responsibilities of the two are different.
Mm-hmm.
He is more in charge of the bigger map.
Okay.
The bigger picture of how the kids are going to be brought up. Like, you know, setting the guidelines of education and child raising.
Okay.
And then implementing these into the lives of the children, you need someone who is very tolerant, who is very loving, caring, emotional, tender,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which is the woman. But the thing is that what has happened actually in society is that the second part has remained and has been highlighted. Mothering, mothering, mothering.
Mm-hmm.
And fathering has been restricted to breadwinning. This is the point that I want to highlight.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Something that has been very making my mind so busy lately is that why do they keep saying that women are history makers, women are so powerful? Through women, this happens, and through women, you know, lives of society. And this is, yes, women are very influential in any age, in any
era.
But why are they overloading women? I think they are mocking us.
In what sense?
In the sense that they are putting too much on our shoulders. We are not superwomen. We shouldn't be superheroes. We should be lataskonu alaiha. When you say, no, you're exceptional. No, you can do this. No, you can do that. No, who said I can do? I have to, you know, handle everything that, you know, a man should handle.
Mm.
I don't want to change any. I will change history in my soft, unnoticeable way through my feminine talents. But they are putting me and they are sticking male attributes to me. You're the hero, you're brave, go out, you can do this. I'm going to be a warrior.
Mm.
I'm going to be a fighter.
But looking back in history, even Islamic history, okay, if we disregard other types of history, which are a lot of people like Sayyidah Khadija, Sayyidah Fatima, Sayyidah Zainab, Sayyidah Ma'asuma, Sayyidah Hakima, the mothers of the Aimah, Sayyidah Narjis. They sort of were kind of like warriors.
What did they do? Did the Lady Fatima al-Masuma go out in the public and fight?
She literally did. No, not warriors, not in the sense of picking up a sword and a shield.
How?
That's never the presentation Islam ever gives of a woman.
Okay.
And except in very scarce, very rare instances. But there was a battle to be fought, not necessarily...
A soft battle you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Not necessarily a battle of arms.
but a soft battle. Sayyida Masuma definitely had to leave the comfort of her home to do it. Among all the Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam had almost 40 kids. Most of them were boys. Out of them, Sayyida Masuma had to get up and travel distances on camelback to prove a point.
Right.
Sayyida Zainab, salamullah alayha, Sayyida Narjis, she traveled continents to shape history.
Right.
Right? So I'm thinking that, yeah, sure, Rayhana, laysat biqahramana. She's a flower, okay? She's not your maid. But when it comes down to it, when push comes to shove, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. And sometimes these tough people had to be women, because I think God wanted to prove a point.
Which is
when it comes to my cause, your gender is absolutely irrelevant. I tell you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, no matter how comfortable you've been all your life. Sayyida Zainab, she was a princess, for crying out loud. When she was, during her time in Kufa, when she wanted to leave her home, she'd leave at night and Amir al-Mu'mineen would command all the lights of the alleys to be dimmed, so no one would even see the shadow that Zainab would cast. After Karbala, she was held as captive. Her veil, her outer veil, stripped away from her, people mocking her, throwing food at her, being present at the court of a drunkard, monkey-entertaining, illegitimate man among a bunch of strangers. The daughter of Amir al-Mu'mineen. I mean, if that's not war, I don't know what is.
I think...
And she made history.
I totally agree with you
mm-hmm.
and your beautiful explanation. This is exactly the interpretation of al-mu'minuna wal-mu'minat ba'duhum awliya'u ba'd.
Yeah. In this case, it could mean comrade, friend, fellow, attendant.
How can you say al-mu'minina wal-mu'minat ba'duhum awliya'u ba'd? It's talking about the political stance that men and women can play in a society. Our discussion was regarding the daughters of the Prophet and the Prophet's treatment towards them
yeah.
and how in that sentimental, emotional background of, you know, the Prophet pampering his daughters mm-hmm. and grandchildren, out of such a context where, as you said, Lady Zainab, salamullah alayha, grew up in an atmosphere where her shadow was not even seen in the society. Or Lady mm. Fatima, she said, Wallah, only God knows how happy I got when the Prophet divided the roles in the family, me having to stay at home and taking care of the household chores mm. and Ali alayhi salam to go outside.
Yep, yep.
So these were not super women in the sense that we are defining girls and women empowerment these days in our life. I'm saying that you don't need to be this modern definition of a superwoman.
Rather than superwoman, just you don't need to be masculine, you know, because Sayyida Zahra was happy about not being given masculine duties of having to leave her home and being rubbing shoulders with men in society and digging wells and planting trees and farming and fighting and, you know, going to the marketplace. You don't need to be masculine to be an extraordinary woman.
To be able to, at one point in your life, stand out
yeah,
and to
exactly.
defend your rights.
Right, right.
This
yeah,
is
it
the
makes
point
sense
though,
now.
Right?
Yeah. Thank you so very much, Sister Razia.
Thank you
so very much for our listeners for being with us on yet another episode of Muslim Lady. Until another greeting and salam, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something. Something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The eagerness of the EU and UN bodies to defer to the Israeli regime is further indication that Palestinian human rights workers will be thrown to the wolves, says Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist, in an article titled West Throws Palestinian Rights Groups to the Wolves. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The Zionist regime's criminalization of Palestinians resisting foreign domination did not begin with the recent order declaring six prominent groups terror organizations. This dangerous development is only the logical outcome of decades of impunity and repression against any Palestinian assembly that challenges the Zionist regimes of apartheid, occupation, and colonization. One of the groups targeted by the Zionist regime for Minister Benny Gantz's terror designation order is Al-Haq, which was founded in 1979 and is one of the oldest Arab human rights organizations. Raja Shahada, one of the organization's founders, recounts in the New York Review of Books that the Zionist regime has persistently tried to discredit Al-Haq and his work. In his early years, this meant labeling Al-Haq a front for the Palestine Liberation Organization, which the Zionist regime outlawed before the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1990s. In 1980, the Zionist regime troops, suspicious of cars parked nearby, raided the group's offices during a meeting attended by an Amnesty International representative. Shahada stated in The Guardian recently, "When we lodged the complaint, the army began an interminable investigation of the incident, which after many years was still not concluded." It is but one example of the repression endured by Palestinians as all forms of collective organizing around their rights are treated by the Zionist regime as a security threat. Now, the Zionist regime is applying a draconian 2016 anti-terror law for the first time, accusing Al-Haq and five other groups of operating as covert arms of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party and resistance organization. That group is banned by the Zionist regime as well as the US and the EU because it refuses to go along with the Oslo Accords surrender, refuses to recognize the fake regime of Israel and renounce armed resistance. International law recognizes the legitimacy of armed struggle in anti-colonial and anti-occupation struggles against foreign domination. Criminalizing resistance groups like PFLP serves the oppressor. The Zionist regime has repeatedly jailed lawmaker and human rights defender Khalida Jarrar based on her membership with the PFLP without meaningful protest from Washington and Brussels.
Governments have criminalized the Palestinian Movement for National Liberation by designating PFLP and other factions that reject normalization with their oppressor as terror organizations. Meanwhile, Palestinian human rights groups and other organizations have to divert resources from their core work to fulfill onerous auditing requirements to receive European funding. These conditions, first imposed by U.S. government agencies and private foundations, have increasingly restricted the work of Palestinian groups. Palestinian organizations must deal with funders' increased demands as the Zionist regime arrests their workers, raids their offices, and prevents the staff from traveling abroad or between the West Bank and Gaza. Meanwhile, the U.S. and EU lavish the Zionist regime with weapons and grants to develop repression technology field-tested on Palestinian bodies. The hypocrisy and double standards are mind-boggling. While banning Palestinian resistance groups, Washington flouts U.S. law that prohibits the government from assisting units of foreign militaries when there is credible information that those units violated human rights with impunity. Al-Haq leads the way in monitoring and documenting those human rights violations and advocating to burst the Zionist regime's bubble of impunity at the international level. Al-Haq and two other groups targeted by the Zionist regime's war ministry, Adamir and Defense for Children International Palestine, have filed evidence of war crimes to the International Criminal Court. Benny Gantz is likely being investigated by the court for his military chief and war ministry roles in 2014 and 2021 assaults on Gaza, during which the Zionist regime Air Force bombed civilian towers and obliterated entire families in their homes. As Al-Haq founder Raja Shahada observes, Gantz's terror group order is likely to be followed by one from the Zionist regime's military commander in the West Bank. That would mean that anyone working for any of the six targeted groups or providing services or expressing support for them will be subject to arrest on terrorist charges. Shahada adds, the organization's financial assets will be confiscated, and the Israeli regime banks will stop any funding from reaching it. Barring significant international pressure on the Zionist regime, in 2 months, there won't be a Palestinian civil society, according to Obay Al-Aboudi, director of Bisson Center for Research and Development, one of the targeted groups. When the Zionist regime moves to starve Palestinian groups of the funding necessary to carry out their international advocacy work, its powerful international friends have sought to undermine accountability at The Hague. Their toothless statesmen of concern over the terror group designations must be understood in the context of their willingness to help the Zionist regime evade justice. It took Canada a week to acknowledge the Zionist regime's attack on the Palestinian groups while stating no position against it. In true settler state solidarity with the Zionist regime, Canada made thinly veiled threats to withdraw funding in a letter to the court stating its opposition to an ICC investigation in the West Bank and Gaza last year. Canada also paved the way for the siege on Gaza, now in its 15th year, by boycotting the elected Hamas government and cutting aid to the Palestinian Authority, citing the group's refusal to recognize the fake regime of Israel and give up Palestinians' right to armed resistance.
Ottawa restored funding to the PA a year and a half later after the Western-backed Fatah Party, led by Mahmoud Abbas, seized control of the West Bank, leaving Gaza isolated and forsaken. In Washington, the Biden administration has voiced no protest against the terror group designations. The only government-level pushback has been a draft resolution signed on by a handful of House representatives. The draft resolution upholds the courageous work being done by the six Palestinian civil society organizations defending the human rights of a vulnerable and at-risk Palestinian population living under Israeli regime military occupation. But many more members of Congress on both sides of the political aisle signed on to a letter drafted by the Zionist regime lobby giant AIPAC, supporting the Trump administration's efforts to sabotage the International Criminal Court's probes into war crimes in Palestine and Afghanistan. These efforts included placing economic sanctions on Fatou Bensouda, the former chief prosecutor whose term ended in June, placing her in the company of international terrorists and drug traffickers. Though it has lifted the sanctions, the Biden administration has quietly attempted to pressure the Palestinian Authority into dropping the case at the International Criminal Court. Yet another green light to the Zionist regime to continue to build settlements in violation of international law and kill scores of Palestinians with U.S. weapons without consequence. The eagerness of the EU and UN bodies to defer to the Israeli regime is further indication that Palestinian human rights workers will be thrown to the wolves. The Zionist regime informed the EU embassy in Tel Aviv in advance of its intentions to designate Palestinian rights groups as terrorist organizations. The EU failed to relay this information to member states, some of which have pushed back against the Israeli regime's move. EU spokesperson Peter Stano told the electronic Intifada that we will be engaging Israeli authorities for more information regarding the basis for these designations. It is a statement of total deference to what human rights groups based in occupied territories have called an act of cowardice characteristic of repressive authoritarian regimes.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.